Today's podcast is all about sailors on horseback. First, we've got a story called Jerry Marlin Spike's Ride. And it's a story about an old sailor who takes a ride on a horse, and this horse is running a little too fast for him. And we'll find out what kind of comical end Jerry comes to on his ride, because he's got a ship's anchor with him. And does this anchor help him to slow this horse down or not? And the second part of the podcast, inspired by the story, will be a review of a book called Jack London, Sailor on Horseback, written by Irving Stone in the 1930s. All right, shipmates, welcome back aboard the Sea Stories and Science Fiction podcast. I'm your host, Malcolm Torres. And today's story is called Jerry Marlin Spike's Ride. The clumsy old ship Atalanta, which deserved to be as celebrated for her dull rate of sailing as her beautiful namesake, was for her symmetrical proportions and swiftness in the race, was one afternoon poking along on her way from Havana for cows, with a heavy cargo of sugar and coffee on board. The wind blew hard from the southeast, and being about abeam, the yards were rounded in a little, and the sheets were flowing. The topsails were double-reefed, but there was no great sea on, and the old ship made more fuss in going 5 or 6 knots than other vessels would in going 10 or 11. On looking over the bows, and listening to the noise she made, and seeing the tremendous big white bone she carried in her mouth, you would think she was going a dozen at least. A sailor dislikes a dull sailing vessel, a leaky ship, a brutal commander, decayed provisions, short allowance of water, poor sails and rigging, etc., etc., are bad enough in all conscience, but a dull sailing vessel is the worst of all. Jack can easily forgive many bad qualities in his ship, and even put up with bad usage with a tolerable grace, if the vessel in which his fortunes are embarked sails fast. In his view, a clear run, like charity, covers a multitude of sins, while a dull sailing vessel, although extremely comfortable in other respects, is his utter aversion. On the afternoon in question, the starboard watch of the Atalanta were snugly coiled away under the weather bulwarks, amidships, busily employed in knotting rope yarns, while Mr. Hopkins, the second officer, was walking the quarterdeck and watching the weather, which looked rather greasy to windward. The captain was quietly taking an observation below in his stateroom. The watch were grumbling about the slow progress they made, and calculating that, if the wind held fair, in about 60 days longer, the Atalanta might arrive in the English Channel. She had already been out 35 days. The whole crew seemed exceedingly impatient and cross, and grumbled away in the most approved manner, excepting one little queer-looking fellow whom they used to call Jerry Marlin Spike, on account of his sharp and peaked visage. He was about 4 feet 11 inches in height, thick-set and spry as a cat aloft. His eyes looked in half a dozen directions apparently at the same time. His mouth was twisted as if he had been the victim of a paralytic shock. His face was seamed with several scars, and his nose stood all askew, as if it had been knocked off, and afterwards a part of it stuck on with a piece of putty, but in the wrong place. Indeed, his whole visage spoke, as plainly as a face could speak, of horrible encounters, of combats dire by flood or field, either with inanimate or inanimate objects. Jerry listened for some time with a grim smile to the remarks of his shipmates. At length, after turning over his huge quid 2 or 3 times, and making some attempts to pucker up his mouth in such a sort as to convey articulate sounds to the ears of the listeners, he addressed his watchmates in a croaking bullfrog kind of voice, something after the following fashion. "I tell you what it is, shipmates. The old barkie goes along fast enough. She's a good, comfortable craft, and we are treated as well on board of her as we deserve. That you'll all allow. And the more months, the more dollars, you know. I expect to go to sea all my life, or until my timbers become so case-hardened that I can't go aloft, and I find myself so well off, with a good ship under my foot, good provisions and plenty of them, kind officers, and a clever set of fellows for a crew, that I shan't trouble myself about the end of the passage, until it begins to grow shoal water in the carnace cask, or the bread room becomes empty. It will be time enough to grumble then about long passages, according to my reckoning. That's all true, Jerry, said Tom Haines, but then you know 'tis a dreadful trial for a fellow's patience to see a stout ship crawl along so slowly with a fair wind and plenty of it. She puts me in mind of a seal trying to dance a hornpipe or a Galapagos tortoise in search of a goanna. I wonder Captain Spriggins don't station a man on the taffrail all night to keep a bright look out astern, lest some decent sailing craft should run us down. There would be more sense in that than in making such a fuss about a sharp lookout on the forecastle. Well, Tom, rejoined Jerry, the lazy Atalanta sails fast enough for me. I am sick of your clippers. I used to like going quick on the sea or on shore as well as any of you, but I got enough of it about 5 years ago, pointing to his battered face, and have never wanted to go faster than 4 or 5 knots an hour since, either on land or on the ocean. How was it, Jerry? Tell us about it, exclaimed 2 or 3 of the watch, hoping to get a yarn on stretch of a different kind from those they were busied in knotting. Why, you see, said Jerry Marlin Spike, I had just returned from an 18 months voyage to Calcutta, and being an Indian blade with plenty of shiners in my pocket, I thought it but right to cut up a few shines on shore, just to astonish the natives, you see. So on the morning after I got ashore, I felt all alive for a spree, and determined to have a ride. That's right, said Jim Wilder. Hire a hack, and I'll go with you. Avast there, shipmate, said I. I intend to go on horseback. At this determination they all laughed and asked me if I was ever on a horse in my life. I told them no, but that was no reason why I should never mount one, that it was never too late to learn that riding on horseback was good for one's health, that I wanted exercise and felt convinced that a good rattling gallop would do me good, and away I posted down the livery stable. After a long confab with the stable keeper, and deposited $100 to pay for the horse in case I killed him or ran away with him, the horse was bought out. I was a strapping fellow. I had a sharp and roguish eye. I believe the rascal knew that I was a green hand at such business. I did not like his looks. The owner told me how to hold the reins and steer him by pulling one to starboard or port, as occasion might require. But, said he, he is a high-spirited animal, and you must look out that he does not run away with you. That would be a good joke, said I, and I should not hear the last of it for 6 months, but I know how to put a stopper on that business at once. So I led my horse down to the wharf where my old ship was discharging, and asked the mate to lend me a small boat's grapnel and a piece of rattling stuff, which he did, for Mr. Ramsey was a clever fellow. Although he used to bother us a good deal in his watch in trimming the sails and bracing the yards, I fastened the rope around the horse's neck, then made a snug coil of the rest on the bow of the saddle, and on the top of all I put my anchor, ready to let go, bring up my craft all standing if she got too much way on. But I was always as fond of going fast as any of you chaps on board the Atalanta, and didn't believe there was much danger. After getting everything ready, I was helped up to the horse's back, and I never felt so queer in my life. A horse knows a thing or two. The cunning creature lifted up his head and gave me a look over his larboard shoulder, as if he would say, I'll fix you, my lad, before we get back, and I would have given $50 to have been at that time standing on the Flemish horse at the end of the Montezuma's main topsail yard, reefing topsails in a gale of wind. but it was too late to alter my plan, and neck or nothing was then my motto, so I determined to heave ahead and save the tide, especially as I had my anchor at the bow, all ready to go if I found myself getting among the breakers. I tell you what, shipmates, this riding on horseback is a serious thing, unless you are used to it. Such pitching and rolling I never met with before nor since, not even when sending down topgallant yards in a gale of wind off the Falkland Islands. They told me how to steer, but hauling hard on the starboard rope when I wished him to go more to starboard, and on the larboard rope when I wished him to go to port. If I wish to heave too, I must bring an equal strain to bear on both the ropes and take a strong pull. We started off and seemed to understand each other very well for a while. The horse did not seem inclined to go fast, and I managed to keep my perpendicular pretty well. But the boys shouted, and the men grinned as I rode along the street, and having gathered courage, I, like a fool as I was, resolved to clap on more sail and get out of town where I should find plain sailing and be able to crowd on every stitch of canvas. Accordingly, I gave my good friend a touch with my whip, and off he started with a jerk that came near tumbling me off the taffrail, and just then some little powder monkeys, bad luck to them, set up a hideous yell which frightened him, and away he went, kicking and sprawling and galloping at a rate of 15 or 20 knots, with poor Jerry on his back. I clung to him like a wet Guernsey frock on the back of a sailor, and although at first rather tickled than otherwise at the idea of going at such a furious rate, I soon found I could not stand it long, for my ship was mighty uneasy and plunged as if scudding against a head sea, immediately after the shifting of the wind in a hurricane. Such a jolting and pounding as I got has seldom fallen to the lot of a poor Jack Tar. My tarpaulin was soon left behind, and I felt as if every timber about me would be shaken out of place. I dropped the whip, grabbed the reins, and pulled with all my might, but it was of no use. I might as well have tried to sway up the main topsail by pulling upon the main topgallant stay. Indeed, the more I pulled, the faster the creature went. The town I soon left far astern and passed by fields and bushes and pastures and trees and houses and carts and men and women and children who all looked on with open mouths and staring eyes as if they had never seen a horse running away with a sailor before. More than once I was within an ace of being pitched heels over head into the jungle alongside the road. Notwithstanding, I had by this time dropped the bridle and clung to the horse's mane. I grew dizzy, which you know, shipmates, is a disagreeable feeling, and was in hopes that my cutter would soon shorten sail and allow a fellow a little time to breathe. But no, on he went, over bridges, hills, and valleys. Nothing seemed to stop him or lessen his speed, and at last I came to the conclusion that it would be as well to bring the ship to an anchor. We soon came to a spot where the bottom was muddy and rocky, which I thought must prove to be good holding ground. I took my rigger's knife from the sheath, although, while so doing, I had liked to have gone overboard head first. I cut the stops which fastened my ground tackling to the saddle and sung out, "Stand by the anchor!" "Aye, aye, sir!" By hauling taut upon the larboard rein, I brought my ship up into the wind in true sailor fashion, but with all my seamanship, I could not manage to check the ship's way. "Let go the anchor," shouted I at the top of my lungs, and overboard it went, and made such a rattling about the heels of the runway that he bounded faster than ever. "Thinks it to myself, old boy, your race will soon be run," but I found, to my sorrow, that the cable had all run out, and the holding ground was good for nothing. The anchor dragged, and for a time did not check the rate of the beast any more than a kedge and towline would a ship of 500 tons when in the outer roads of Buenos Aires during a pampero. I began to think that it was a gone case with poor Jerry when the anchor caught behind a big rock, slewed the bow of the ship right around, and brought her up all standing. I was not prepared for coming to so suddenly, and away I went like a skyrocket, about 15 or 20 yards further, and landed among the rocks. The shock was so violent that all my seven senses were completely knocked out of me. When I came to, I found myself lying on a bed with my hull and upper works pretty well battered, and a doctor hard at work paying and caulking the seams and repairing damages. That was no easy matter, shipmates, you may rely upon it, for three of my ribs and my collarbone were broken, and I received a severe wound on the side of my head, which the doctor said would have finished me if my skull had not been uncommonly thick. My face was bruised and cut, so that not even my own mother would have known her darling Jerry if she had been on the spot, and my nose was completely unshipped and lay keel out of the starboard side of my face. The doctor had a tough job of it, as well as myself, and it was a long time before I was able to do duty on board ship. My nose, and indeed my whole phiz, was put sadly out of joint, as you see, and I have never been in a hurry since. So, Jerry Marlin Spikes ride, and I guess it was a good thing, or maybe not such a good thing, that he brought that anchor with him. I just like the way that he uses all the nautical terms to describe the way the horse handles and the way he steers the horse and finally gets the horse to stop. Truly a sailor on horseback. This story that we just heard, Jerry Marlin Spikes Ride, was from an old book called Ocean Adventures, written by John Sherborne Sleeper in Boston in the 1850s. And it's about a sailor on horseback, and it made me think of the book Jack London, Sailor on Horseback. It was a biography of Jack London written by Irving Stone in the 1930s. And just the story itself, the way it read and the character made me think of Jack London and this book. So I figured we'd do a two for one here. But before we move ahead into the review of Jack London, Sailor on Horseback, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Any fan of great sea stories should definitely read Jack London. He's got many, many great sea stories that you can greatly enjoy. But there was a biography written about Jack London entitled Jack London, Sailor on Horseback by Irving Stone. And this was a wonderful book. And I read it many years ago, and I've reread parts of it recently and just been thinking about it. And I went online and I found a review, and it's on bobsbeenreading.wordpress.com. This fellow Bob, he's got a great review of this. I'll just read a couple of quick sections of it. He summarizes the book. He says, a summary in three sentences. Jack London grew up very poor in San Francisco area in the late 1800s with very little support from his family, was largely on his own in a very rough world to survive and get by. Blessed by an intrepid spirit, he confidently dove into the toughest environments and toughest challenges, and with pluck, grit, and uncanny ability to get along with people, he managed to survive and prevail. After many amazing adventures and many false starts as a writer, he eventually became one of the most successful and best recognized authors in the world. But like many other such great adventurers, his toughness and skill at managing physical challenges and adversity did not translate into a well-managed life in the labyrinth of civilization, and his generosity and appetite for always wanting more eventually were his undoing. And that is really a great summary of the book, but also of Jack London's life. And in bobsbeenreading.wordpress.com, he's got a few other impressions that he shares that I agree with wholeheartedly. He shares a couple paragraphs from Irving Stone's book, just as a kind of to give a little flavor, and I'll read that here. He had a strong, gregarious instinct. He liked to rub against his own kind, yet in society he saw himself as a fish out of water. Because of his background, he took to conventionality uneasily, rebelliously. He was used to saying what he thought, nothing more nor less. The hard hand of adversity laid upon him at the age of 10 had left him sentiment, but destroyed sentimentality. It had made him practical so that he was sometimes known as hard, stern, and uncompromising. It had made him believe that reason was mightier than imagination, that the scientific man was superior to the emotional man. "Take me this way," he wrote to Anne Strunsky in the early days of their acquaintanceship. A stray guest, a bird of passage splashing with salt-rimmed wings through a brief moment of your life, a rude, blundering bird used to large airs and great spaces, unaccustomed to the amenities of confined existence. So that's a little sample of the writing that you'll find in the book. And then another nice thing that Bob's been reading does is he says here, there were four primary periods of London's life that he turned to mine his experiences for his short stories and novels. One, his time on the waterways around San Francisco as a young sailor, oyster pirate, and then as a fish patrol official. Number two, his time as an able-bodied seaman on the sealing schooner in the Pacific. Number three, his time as a tramp, crisscrossing the United States looking for short-term work, food, and hanging out with other tramps. And four, perhaps most importantly, his time in the Klondike during the Alaska Gold Rush. And five, his sailing voyage in his sailing ship, the Snark, to Hawaii, the South Pacific, and Southeast Asia. It's kind of cute. Bob's been reading, says there are four primary periods, and then he gives us five, which is awesome. It's kind of a bonus. So this article on bobsbeenreading.wordpress.com on Bob's review of the book is just wonderful. Bob's a great writer and very insightful in his review of this book. But if you like good sea stories, there's plenty here for you. We've got Ocean Adventures, the book of short stories we've been reading here on the podcast. We've also got several other book reviews that we've done. And now we've got another book review of Jack London's Sailor on Horseback, written by Irving Stone. So there you have it, folks. Another episode of the Sea Stories and Science Fiction podcast is in the books. Again, as always, I'm going to ask you, reach out to me on Twitter. On Facebook, we have a group called Sea Stories and Science Fiction. You can reach out to me there, join the group. You can follow along with episodes and we can have some dialogue there. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. So I look forward to forming a little community out there with you and seeing your comments. So thanks for joining us. And I look forward to another episode in a few days.